Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today with a former advisor to four presidents, David Gergen, who now says he sees troubling signs that the Bush White House wants war with Iran. But first, President Bush has tapped a so-called law and order conservative to become the 81st Attorney General of the U.S. and hopefully quell the turmoil under Alberto Gonzalez. The president nominated Michael Mukasey. He's a retired federal judge from New York who's presided over several high-profile terrorism cases, sometimes ruling against the Bush administration. Today, the president said Mukasey is clear-eyed about the threats that face the nation and praised him for his work in the days after the 9/11 attacks.
He and other judges in his district worked day and night to ensure that applications for warrants were processed, investigations could proceed, and the rule of law was upheld.
Joining us on the line, Rick Schmidt of the Los Angeles Times. And Rick, how would you characterize Mukasey politically?
Well, he's a very apolitical guy. He's a serious, weighty choice, a man of substance, a legal substance, but I suppose if one had to characterize his rulings from a judicial perspective, he's probably, you know, viewed as a conservative. But he's never worked in Washington. He was a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan in the early 1970s, but inside the Beltway here, he's largely unknown.
Well, we were hearing that the question might be also, is he conservative enough? He's drawn praise from some top Democrats, Senator Charles Schumer. Saying Mukasey could become a consensus nominee, but what do conservatives have to say?
It's interesting that a guy can garner the respect of both Chuck Schumer and the president. But there were some initial concerns, I think, among conservatives evolving predominantly around a ruling that the judge made in the early 1990s in connection with a political asylum case. The judge has already reached out to those groups as well as conservative members of Congress yesterday and today, and we're already starting to see some of them come around. So apparently after they meet the guy, they seem to be satisfied with him.
Tell us about some of the high-profile terrorism cases he's ruled on.
Some of the first Islamic radicalism cases that hit the U.S. courts before 9/11. He was involved in the high-profile trial of the so-called blind sheikh in the mid-1990s in connection with a plot to blow up landmarks in New York. After 9/11, he handled some of the early stages of the case, the prosecution, and then prosecution, and then the detainee proceeding involving Jose Padilla, who just last month was convicted of terrorism charges in Miami. So he's viewed as a person that is well known and thought a lot about national security issues, which of course are near and dear to the administration.
But how has he perhaps ruled against the administration in some of those cases?
Well, for example, in the Padilla case early on, after the administration had deemed him an enemy combatant and it was denying him access, among other things, lawyers, he ruled that that while it was okay for the government to hold him, that Padilla at least had the right to see his lawyers, and it was very emphatic about that, which was a right that the administration wasn't interested in providing Padilla at that point.
Well, if he's approved by Congress, Mukasey is going to have a difficult job ahead. He takes over a Justice Department where morale is low, and also he's potentially taking on some really high-profile issues, warrantless wiretapping. He'd be involved in deciding when that would be administered. He's thought to be in line with the president's thinking on executive powers. But as we're going to hear when we speak to David Gergen, some of that thinking now might be that war with Iran might be on the horizon. As I said, we're going to talk about that. I'm not asking you to. But there might be a lot on this attorney general's plate.
That's true. I think you're absolutely right. His thinking is in sync with the president's in terms of the country needs to have a forceful and aggressive posture so far as issues related to national security, including giving law enforcement officers so-called tools that they need in order to keep the country safe. And so I think they are like-minded in that regard. On the other hand, the president doesn't know Mukasey. I think the first meetings that he had, which apparently predated just slightly the president's trip to Australia for the Asian Pacific summit, the first of the month, were the first times that he ever met him. Mm. And so, in a way, the president's flying blind, I guess, to a certain extent. Although Mukasey does has a long track record as a judge and a private lawyer and as a prosecutor.
Rick Schmidt of the Los Angeles Times speaking to us about the nomination today of Michael Mukasey as the 81st Attorney General of the United States. He'll, of course, have to go to a confirmation process. Rick, thanks so much.
You bet.
The French foreign minister is warning that the world should prepare for another war, this time over Iran's nuclear program. Yesterday, Bernard Kouchner said, "We have to prepare for the worst, and the worst is war." Iran responded that the French are just aping the U.S., and Britain's Sunday Telegraph took that angle a little further, reporting that Pentagon planners have developed a list of up to 2,000 bombing targets in Iran, and the White House has begun a carefully calibrated escalation that could lead to military strikes on Iran. Well, those warnings, combined with one from our next guest, lead us to focus again on U.S.-Iran relations. Joining us on the line from Iowa, where he has a speaking engagement today, is former presidential advisor David Gergen, director of the Center for Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And David, last week on our NPR sister show, On Point, you said there are disturbing signs that we may well have a war with Iran before the current administration leaves the White House. It certainly caught our ear. You had a real sense of urgency. You know, it was a somber tone in your voice. What prompted you to say that?
Well, I think all signs point toward an escalating set of tensions between Iran and the United States that could easily touch off some sort of military conflict. There are factions within the Bush administration we've known for a long time, headed by the vice president, who have believed that the United States ought to pursue a more confrontational approach with Iran, one to contain Iran, to stop it from building nuclear weapons, and to be prepared in final resort to strike Iran militarily. While there are other factions led by the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, that would prefer a more diplomatic approach and have been pushing hard on diplomacy that isn't apparently working. And I think what's striking, what's been developing recently, is that the Iranians appear to be becoming much more mischievous and aggressive in Iraq, and the United States is pushing back. The president's speech to the nation, the Petraeus testimony, the Crocker testimony of last week, all ratcheted up the rhetoric against Iran. And so we're having a growing sense that there's a potential, you know, an incident could bring a conflict as the Iranians mess around in Iraq, and as we find and as we assert that the Iranians are causing all sorts of problems, you could easily have an incident that would touch off a military strike of some sort. And I just think we have to be aware of the shift in the president's own rhetoric.
What did you hear? What did you hear in the president's speech that prompted you to think there had been a shift?
Well, as the New York Times noted in its front page yesterday on Sunday, the president is now giving as a rationale for staying in Iraq the need to contain Iran. There are many reasons why the president has given for staying in Iraq, of course. But he clearly is now circling Iran in a new way. And I must tell you, there have been rumors of conflict, rumors of war, if you will, circulating in Washington for more than a year now.
And Seymour Hersh wrote about it quite a while ago.
Yes, absolutely. I remember a major journalist who got a call in August a year ago from top-level military folks saying something's about to go down, you've got to get into this. There are many, many in the military who do not want to have a military strike against Iran. They think that it would might quickly lead to some sort of effort to destabilize or decapitate the regime in Iran, and the army in particular, you know, now that they're so pinned down in Iraq, there's a lot of apprehension about doing anything with Iran. But I must say, I also think that in this mix, you have the possibility of the almost certain likelihood that there are going to be at least one or two advisors around this president, who will believe that his successor, whoever it may be, Democrat or Republican, is going to be a wuss compared to this president. And they will believe, they do believe, that Iran constitutes an even more important threat to the United States and stability in the Middle East if it gains a nuclear weapon. And so if you're in that position, they're going to push and they're going to argue President Bush is the only fellow with the courage and the guts to do it from their perspective. And therefore, we ought to do it because nobody else will.
Well, the Sunday Telegraph reports that senior officials, as you said, in President Bush's inner circle, have decided that he will not leave. He doesn't want to leave office without first ensuring that Iran is not capable of developing a nuclear weapon.
Well, I must say that if you, I was recently engaged in a war game that CNN is had put together that's going to be for this fall in a special they're doing on Iran. And if you begin to look at the options, if Iran does get to nuclear weapons capability, the options for the United States are really pretty horrendous. There would be some who'd argue we have to learn to live with a nuclear Iran, and once you go down that track, it's pretty grim. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you say, well, let's go get them militarily, that's very grim, too. So I came out of that believing that we ought to be doing everything we can diplomatically to head this off.
Well, and David, you know, many people thought that's what was happening. We remember recently, famously, Iran came for talks in Baghdad, and there was thinking that a solution in Iraq went through Iran.
Well, that's exactly right. And I must say, I don't think one should apportion blame here, but it does appear that the Iranians are unwilling to right now to show much flexibility. That there are a lot of some radical hotheads there, who are calling some of the shots, especially with the Revolutionary Guard. And so on one hand you have a recalcitrance on the part of the Iranians in recent talks with the United States, because we have actually engaged them now a couple of times. And at the same time, there are those in the United States government who don't want to give very much to Iran. You know, they don't want to. They're not putting many carrots on the table. There are a lot of sticks, but there are not many carrots. And so both sides, I think, need to do some reexamination. And what we are hearing now may also be an attempt to, use rhetoric to convince the Iranians, hey, if you keep messing around in Iraq, you're playing with fire. And you don't want to do that. And so some of what the president's engaged in rhetorically may be an effort to get the Iranians to call off their misconduct.
Well, David,
on the other hand, these kind of once you start ratcheting up rhetoric, as we know from the whole axis of evil speech and many, many other instances in history, things get more dangerous, and it's easy to get to have one incident touch off a larger confrontation.
I'm speaking with former presidential advisor David Gergen, director of the Center for Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, who's hearing an escalation in the war of words between the Bush White House and Iran. And this note, the Sunday Telegraph is also quoting an anonymous senior intelligence officer as saying that a prime target of U.S. attacks could be the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Quds Force in southern Iran. They're said to be manufacturing projectiles that are used by insurgents in Iraq. The hope would be to provoke a response from Iran, and that could justify and trigger bigger airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facility. So is this all, as David just said, perhaps just a bluff to get Iran to back down from its support of insurgents? Is there a role here for diplomacy? We'll have more with David Gergen after a break. And later in the program, don't forget, how bad is the drought in the southeast U.S.? That's still to come as well. Back after the break, here and now. We're talking about Iran with a man who has advised four U.S. presidents. He says he's hearing language that tells him that the White House debate over Iran, the forces for war, are winning out over the backers of more diplomacy. David Gergen is director of the Center for Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. David, I'm sure you're aware that our conversation sounds a lot like the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. And we also have Mohammed El-Baradei, head of the U.N.'s International Atomic Energy Agency, saying that they're trying agreements with Iran, trying to play out the diplomatic hand.
They are indeed, but the question is, what do we have to offer Iran that would make them more, that would induce them or persuade them to give up their nuclear ambitions and to call off their sponsorship of terrorism, both of which are important. From my perspective, it's important that we have large sticks, but that we ought to be offering carrots to make it clear to the Iranians, if they are willing to behave, they will be welcomed into the to the fraternity of nations, and the United States will not try to decapitate their regime. After all, from the Iranian point of view, there is a very real sense that our ultimate goal is to get rid of their government. And
it seems as if it is.
Well, it's unclear. Going back in history, one should read John F. Kennedy and how much he was influenced by Barbara Tuchman, the historian, about the outbreak of World War One and the miscalculations that on both sides of the other's intentions, and how that led to growing confrontations, growing tensions, and eventually a war. And Kennedy, I read that book shortly before the Cuban Missile Crisis, and made sure that everyone in the army officers' quarters had a chance to and was asked to read the same book. That book is now Barbara Tuchman's book on the Guns of August is highly relevant today.
For those who haven't read it, are you saying that words that some say are coming largely from the office of the vice president, to the effect that there needs to be regime change in Iran to change, as you called it, the mischief across the border in Iraq? You're saying that there might be a misunderstanding on the part of Iran that those words aren't, they're not going to follow through on them, that they just want them to back down?
Let's see the kind of rhetorical escalation we've seen in recent days. I mean, we had the president's speech, which made it clear that Iran was, that he was taking a more confrontational view toward Iran. Now we have the French foreign minister saying we must prepare for the worst, and the worst is war. Now, and if you're sitting there in Tehran listening to that language, you have to say, well, maybe they're getting ready to come get us, and that then prompts them to take various steps to defend themselves, to accelerate if they can their nuclear building program, to get it further hidden away, put it deeper in caves and that sort of thing, make it harder to strike, and then we then think they're getting ready to get a nuclear weapon. I mean, these kind of things have a way of, have we seen in the building of military stockpiles, or you get into a race against each other, and that often leads to a bad outcome. So I think where we are right now is we have to be very somber and sober about what we're facing. Iran with a nuclear weapon would be extraordinarily destabilizing. It's important that not happen. It's not in America's interest, not in the world's interest, not in Iran's interest for Iran to have a nuclear weapon with hotheads like that in charge. And at the same time, it's extremely important that we keep our powder dry and see if we can't. I think Condi Rice is should be listened to here, and to certainly explore to the absolute nth degree what can be worked out diplomatically, because war should be the absolute last resort here. It's worth remembering, after we've gotten so stuck in Iraq, that Iran has three times as many people as Iraq, and the land mass of Iran is four times that of Iraq. This is a big and fairly sophisticated country.
David Gergen, the Sunday Telegraph is reporting that Condoleezza Rice, in fact, is, a bottom line. She says that if the administration is to go to war again, it must build the case over a period of months and win sufficient support on Capitol Hill. And again, the Sunday Telegraph has reported that President Bush has privately promised her that he would consult with congressional leaders and that she would resign if this didn't, he understood that she would resign if this didn't happen. What are you hearing about how this might play out?
Well, I think we're all hearing that there is that there are disagreements within the administration about the approach. You can listen to John Bolton, who is who left the State Department, who has been very, very tough about North Korea and Iran, and thinks that inevitably we're probably going to have to deal with Iran militarily. That is the sentiment that is being expressed on one side within the administration, and then there are others, in the vice president's office, and there's still some others, and even though Don Rumsfeld has left, there's still some of the neocons have left. There are others still there. On the other hand, you've got the Condi Rice view, which is much more diplomatic and is much more what the Europeans want to hear. There's a meeting coming up now that the U.S. State Department is going to host with nations of Europe and China and Russia and the like to figure out where to go now in the U.N. Are we going to go up and we're going to ratchet up the sanctions? If these other nations are unwilling to go along with tougher sanctions against Iran, and they're showing some reluctance, that's going to strengthen the hands of the Dick Cheney forces. And they're going to say, well, listen, there's nobody else willing to do this. As tough as it's going to be, we've got to be the ones who have the courage, the Churchillian courage, to stand up to this threat. I mean, that you can just hear the arguments.
Well, and one last question. What do you make of Israel's military incursion into Syrian airspace earlier this month? Syria's ambassador to the U.S. told Newsweek that Israel dropped some bombs in an open desert. But very few Arab governments commented on that. Iran, again, a backer of Syria.
Well, that's a very, very interesting and important point. The international community has read the Israeli incursion as sending off a potential message that they're sort of warming up for a potential strike against Iran. And the fact that the other Arab nations, especially the Sunni nations, did not object is being read in some quarters. I think it's a little strained, but it's being read in some quarters as the Sunni nations, you know, such as Saudi Arabia, wouldn't mind all that much if the West took action against Iran, because after all, they're very afraid of the rise of the Shia Crescent. I would bet that, look, anytime you're talking about the West striking a Muslim nation, that's going to drive an awful lot of Shias and Sunnis together in the Middle East. And so we ought not to overread the silence of the Arab nations. This is very complex stuff. And the next few months are going to be extremely important, because I do think this administration is going to be much tougher about Iran than its successor even knows it. And Iran knows that.
Former presidential advisor David Gergen, director of the Center for Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, with his ear to the ground in Washington, the talk of a possible attack on Iran, telling us what he's been hearing. David, thank you.
Thank you.
And, of course, we'll continue to follow that story for you. Looking ahead today, we'll hear a mashup of Mozart and Rossini and a little bit of The Daily Show thrown in, coming up here and now. This summer's drought is being described as the worst since the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. You might be saying, what drought? And that may be because, unlike the 30s dry spell, which withered 63% of the nation, only 37% of the country is affected today. And today, most Americans live in cities. So with the exception of food price increases at the supermarket or restrictions on watering your lawn, you're not going to feel the impact as much as people are, say, in the Southeast, a dry patch reaching from Mississippi to Virginia. That's where we found John Henry Smith on his 1,400-acre farm in Rosedale, Virginia, where he raises beef cattle. He's here to tell us more about this parched summer. John Henry, welcome.
Welcome, Robin.
We understand that there's drought and then there's bad drought. The U.S. Drought Monitoring Center classifies your area as exceptional drought. You know, what does that mean? Can you describe for us, you know, how dry it is? How can you paint that picture for us?
It is an exceptional drought. I've been farming since I came home from college in 1972, and it's far and away the driest summer that we've ever had. We had a relatively dry winter, and then we had a late spring freeze that lasted several days. And since then, we've had very, very little rain. The hay, which we produce to feed the cattle, is probably 50%. We've reduced our herd of cattle starting in July by probably a good solid third. And to make it through the winter, the pastures are gone. Lots of our water comes from mountain springs and mountain streams, which have dried up. We're not out of water, but the locations have certainly varied.
When you say that you raise this this hay to, you know, the grass grasses to feed the cows, the cattle, you know, what happens when it dries up? I mean, obviously, you've got a very thriving farm. Are they starving? How does that work?
No, we wouldn't have any, you know, any cattle starving. But, they're very short. They're probably not as in good a condition as they normally are. And we've gotten through the summer. It's the winter that really concerns us now. Our hay supply is short, and we depend a lot on fall grazing, stockpile grasses that we allow to grow up in the late summer and early fall, and then the cattle graze them in the early part of the winter before the snows come.
What do you have to do, in addition to selling off the herd, what do you have to do to replace the food?
We may have to supplement these cattle with some commodity grains in the winter to get the remainder of the herd through, and we are sending part of the cattle to another county that has had some rain, and will be contract wintered over there.
Well, when you say you have to supplement the food, though, you buy feed for them, and we understand the drought has driven up the price of the feed as well.
It has.
Yeah.
It has.
Talk about selling off the herd. You know, some would say, well, what's the problem? You do like anyone has to do. If you have a shortage of something, you reduce elsewhere, and that keeps your costs low. How does it affect a cattle farmer when you have to sell off the herd earlier maybe than you might have planned?
Well, when you have a widespread drought like this, there's not many people locally that want to buy any of these cows. Lots of these are good productive cows. Now, there is an end that went on to slaughter, but a lot of them are good productive cows to have several more years left in their life. And with a widespread drought, everybody's in the same boat. Nobody has any extra feed. So we've taken a good bit less for these cattle than we normally would.
Have you had to sell off what we understand farmers call good mama cows?
Exactly.
Why do you call them that?
They're just good productive cows, good milking cows, raise a large calf, easy to handle. They're just good cows.
And you've had to sell those?
We have sold some of those. We have sold some that we would prefer not to sell.
Well, you know, this is a difficult conversation for people who, would rather see you keep the cows and milk them, you know, than sell them at all for meat, you know. And I'm wondering, your family's been farming this land since 1775, and you've had to switch, you know, what you farm in the past because of, well, different reactions to different things. For instance, the tobacco market. Did you farm tobacco at one point?
I was a tobacco farmer in the early days. This farm grew a lot of flax in the 1700s, early 1800s. And that's one thing about agriculture. If you're not adaptable, you're not going to stay on that piece of land. Yeah. Weather and prices are the big thing in all industry, but especially agriculture. You're really just a slave to what the weather does to you.
Well, I guess that's my question. What would you say to people who are listening who maybe they don't eat meat, for instance, and they're saying, you know, maybe the drought is telling you that this is a time to, you know, switch your farming to something else? Why should, you know, people be concerned about what's happening to you and your farm?
Most cattle farmers and most farmers, despite some of the national press, are really good stewards of the land. They take good care of it. And it just happens in my area that our niche with our mountains and cool temperatures and grassland fits a beef cattle operation. But I have friends in Alabama who couldn't grow a cotton crop. Hmm. I have friends, you know, in Tennessee who couldn't grow corn or soybeans. I have a friend in Kentucky, an organic vegetable farmer, whose crop was severely hurt by the drought. So when you get a widespread drought like this, it affects everyone in every phase of agriculture and eventually to the consumer.
Right. And as we said, the price that they pay for some of these items or whether or not they can even get them. Well, what kind of relief is there for you? What kind of financial relief?
We've been declared a disaster county by the federal government. The first step in that is low-interest loans. And I know none of this for sure, but the rumor is there'll be some tax credit deferral of income, maybe even some economic help for those who dispersed cattle early.
Right. What kind of impact are you seeing this have on your fellow farmers? We hear, you know, there's been some real psychological impact on them.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's very depressing. It's cooled off a little now, but 3 weeks ago we were having no rain and upper 90 temperatures. And, you know, you just see your farms just withering away. I mean, you see the leaves on the trees and the mountains drying up. It has an impact. And farmers are not a youthful bunch anymore. At 57, I'm considered a fairly young farmer. I think the average age is probably in the 60s. So it's definitely had an impact. It's very depressing.
We understand the University of Tennessee Agricultural Extension Service did some studies and made some observations that they're starting to see the problems they saw in the 1980s farm debt crisis when more than 900 farmers in the upper Midwest committed suicide. You know, it's a stressful time. And yet, as we noted, it's only, you know, it doesn't affect the entire country. The areas that it affects, like yours, it affects profoundly. But outside of that, people may not even be aware.
Yeah. And, you know, a few years ago, we had a terrific drought in Texas. Now it rains every day in Texas where it's not supposed to rain.
We understand you're heading to the capital, Richmond, later today to meet with other farmers. Drought is going to be item number one on the agenda. What will you talk about?
Well, like most farmers, we'll talk about the weather, and we'll talk about the drought and how it affects our businesses and other ag-related business. Agriculture has lots of fingers that go out, from processing to retailing to manufacturing. It's not just a farmer on the farm. It stretches all through the economy.
John Henry Smith, beef cattle farmer in Rosedale, Virginia, who's dealing with the drought that's plaguing his area. Mr. Smith, thank you very much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Robin.
Brief reminder, you can listen to our show stream live at our website, here-now.org. For past programs, you can just click on the archives. You can also download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And before we go today, it's not your grandfather's Figaro. You're listening to Here and Now. Every summer, tens of thousands of kids who are members of 4-H clubs flock to state fairgrounds across the country to showcase their cattle, sheep, pigs, chickens, and other livestock. But just what do the farm kids do when they're not in the judging ring? Producer Nikki Tundell shadowed two 14-year-old girls at this year's Minnesota State Fair in St. Paul to find out.
10 minutes ago, Maggie Jennison and Molly Herberg were asleep on the hay. Literally. The 14-year-olds finished showing their heifers at the Minnesota State Fair, and now they're relaxing on mounds of straw in the cattle barn. The remainder of their afternoon will be spent rolling their eyes at city dwellers, primarily the ones who teeter about the fairgrounds in high heels and insist on plugging their noses as they walk past the well-groomed cows and calves.
Some people are really weird. They'll ask you just really odd questions, like
they ask why is it a boy or a girl when it has an udder? Yeah.
Maggie's from Brewton, Minnesota. Molly's from St. Peter. The two spend a surprising amount of time explaining that it's the females, and only the females, that have udders. The two friends have been in 4-H since they were in kindergarten. This year they both entered Holstein calves in the dairy competition. For those not in the know, Holsteins are the iconic black and white bovines that produce the majority of America's milk. Maggie competed with her winter yearling Nikki. Molly showed Daffodil.
She's not the nicest animal, but she's just, I don't know, she's just really hyper. She kicks a lot sometimes, but she's nicer than my other one. My other one almost kicked the judge once, and that wasn't good.
This time around, Molly was able to keep her calf from headbutting others in the ring and was awarded a blue ribbon. Maggie picked up a blue as well. So how do these teenage girls celebrate such accomplishments? They go dancing. The first Saturday night of the fair is always set aside for the annual 4-H dance. It's a time for young competitors to let off some steam. For Maggie and Molly, it's a chance to check out 4-Hers of the opposite sex.
Everybody always goes for the beef boys.
Yeah.
Meaning the boys who raise beef cattle.
Then they're better looking. Or they just clean up nicer, I don't know.
The one thing that's obvious about these beef boys is that they wear a lot of cologne. But perhaps that's just to make up for the fact that the dance is held in the swine barn. The judging arena has been swept out to make room for girls in skin-tight tank tops and boys in baggy John Deere t-shirts. Just hours earlier, spectators sat in the stands admiring the muscling on the market hogs. Now chaperones in bib overalls watch as farm kids groove to Justin Timberlake and Green Day and AC/DC. Disco lights hang from the rafters, but the pens are still packed with hogs. A Yorkshire knocks over her water bowl when the DJ starts spinning Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby Got Back. Pretty Ricky, the state's largest boar, appears to sleep through everything, although it's possible the 1,200-pounder is purposely keeping his eyes closed so he won't have to witness 14-year-olds dancing to songs like Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy. Of course, aside from the curly-tailed onlookers, this is actually a pretty typical teen dance. Nearly every song seems to spark at least one conga line. Girls alternate between flipping their hair and sending text messages on their cell phones, and the social cliques remain firmly intact.
Like, the dairy people and the horse people don't get along. Well, that's just the way it goes. You notice that, right? Almost anybody you talk to, that's how it goes.
Despite the inherent rivalries, Maggie and Molly admit there's a common bond among the state's 4-Hers. They all know what it takes to keep a farm going. They know what it feels like to get thrown into a fence by a horse. And they know what it's like to see a newborn lamb take its very first steps.
It's kind of something you explain to your friends, but then you don't really expect them to understand.
Yeah, they get sick of you talking about it. Because they don't really care and they don't really get it. I don't know, it just gets annoying when your friends are like, oh, I had to take out the garbage, and they're complaining, and it's like, come on the farm for once.
Yeah. It does make you feel like you're a little more responsible, that you do a little more.
Yeah.
So how do these hardworking farm girls rate the big dance?
I don't know, it's kind of lame.
And the fabled beef boys?
Creepy. They don't know how to dance. That's like the main problem. And they're really sweaty. It's gross.
As it turns out, raising a prize-winning steer just isn't enough to impress teenage girls these days.
Producer Nikki Tundell. To see photos from the Minnesota State Fair, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, coming up, two Figaros, two counts, two of everything on stage. This must be Minneapolis's June Loon Theater at work. That's after a break, here and now. I'm I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ah, Figaro. Whether it's Rossini or Looney Tunes, we've all heard it. Beaumarchais wrote the story of the wily Figaro who outwits his master, Count Almaviva. Figaro then appears in Rossini's Barbara of Seville, which we're listening to, and Mozart borrows him for his opera, The Marriage of Figaro. The story was censored for many years in France. It was a touchy topic in the run-up to the revolution. But what happened to Figaro and Almaviva after the revolution? Well, a new work picks up that story with a now embittered Figaro ambling around a crumbling mansion with the one-time count, now deranged Mr. Almaviva, hiding in a cabinet.
Why me? Why? Why? Because you love me.
Together, these speaking actors are visited by the singing ghosts of opera's past. Figaro is one of two radical mashups of classic operas from the Minneapolis-based Théâtre de la Jeune Lune, teaming up with the Loeb Drama Center at the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dominique Sarand is the artistic director of the company. He also plays the Count.
Yes.
The deranged Count, shall we
totally
say?
Totally deranged.
Okay. We're also joined by his collaborators, Stephen Epp. You play Figaro.
Yes, the old one.
And music adapter Bradley Greenwald. You play the young and singing Almaviva.
Yes, the young, singing, deranged Almaviva, yes.
It's not exactly what people heard in the opera. In fact, the old Figaro, Figaro, isn't in it.
Right. We freely quote a little bit from the Rossini in the overture and in the piece, but the bulk of the music is from Mozart's opera. We don't necessarily follow the plot of the opera, but we follow the emotional plot of the music. So that was our guideline in how to choose what to sing where.
Well, Stephen, you and Dominique call this layering of stories of opera and play that you use for the plot a river without banks. What do you mean by that?
You take all this source material, all the plays, and you have the opera, and we sort of dump all that out on the table and sort of look at these pieces and what can we do with them and what's the story we want to build out of that. And then you start to reassemble it until it starts to coalesce in some way. It's like making a good sauce.
Dominique, tell us, how does the life of Beaumarchais fit into the story?
Because I think, if I'm correct, Figaro is the last piece written before the revolution. And so it had a great influence. It's one of the last work that we know of before the revolution happened. Beaumarchais himself was a bourgeois who made a lot of money besides being a writer. And he eventually bought himself a huge mansion, I believe, not far away from the Bastille.
It was right across the
Right across.
He watched the Bastille be torn down from his garden.
So, of course, it inspired our production that this man decides to lock himself into his mansion while the revolution is happening.
We see that contrast in a scene we want to listen to. Dominique, you're now the deposed count in your now empty mansion after the revolution. When Jennifer Peden, as Countess Rosina, enters the stage on a beautiful rose-covered boat, she's his memory from before the revolution. She's singing Porgy Amor, a lament for lost love. And she's simultaneously filmed in close-up in front of a backdrop of Versailles at sunset.
The porch is more like a love song, a beautiful love song, the way we looked at it, as an impression of what the Count is missing. He has his beautiful wife, and he's not even paying attention. So it's a very sad. When we looked at it, we said she should be on a boat, and we don't know why.
Just because it looked great.
Well, because we didn't have a car.
Bradley, what happens, again, you had to adapt the music. What happens when opera purists come and see these productions and they don't hear their favorite aria, or they can't figure out why there are speaking Figaros and Counts alongside singing Figaros and Counts? You know, these are people who want their opera straight.
I think most people who come know that they're going to see something that is neither the Beaumarchais play nor the Mozart opera. It's a new piece that uses the music from the opera. If they're looking to hear a particular aria, chances are that it's in this production because almost all of them are sung. And they won't be disappointed at all in its execution. But what they will get is a different environment around the aria, which may make them listen to it as if for the first time again.
There are prejudices, and a lot. It's very interesting when you see critics who come and review the show and critic the show. Based on how successful we are doing the original play or the original opera, which was never our attempt. We're doing a genuine play, and it's a new look.
When Bradley says that they're sung beautifully, they are. They're very physical. They pop up everywhere. They're sort of there's a sleight of hand to the production.
They move, they go on the floor, they roll on the floor.
While singing. In fact, there's a scene where the speaking parts and the singing parts all sort of crash into each other when the singing count, your character Bradley, tells the singing Figaro that he can't marry, and the speaking count, that's you, Dominique, and the speaking Figaro, that's you, Stephen, are suddenly in this, it's sort of like West Side Story with the sharks and the jets, and they're both walking back and forth across stage. Let's listen. Stephen Epp, there's another scene. I want to hear a little of that as well, where the young Susanna and the Countess are plotting to foil the Count. Hilarity ensues. There's hiding in closets. There's, you know, it's sort of a Noel Coward play for a little bit there. But there's also a real, you know, a real sweetness to it. Can you tell me more about the feeling that you're trying to evoke of this
time?
Well,
that particular duet, it really sets up the entire finale of the opera, where all these things eventually ensue in the garden. But the duet itself is a stunning, gorgeous piece. And on the surface, they are just basically setting up a little plot of making this letter that's going to lure the Count to the garden. But you put that in the hands of Mozart, and it becomes the most sort of searing. There's a painful beauty underneath it. I mean, it's not a light little farcical plot. There's this deep longing and pain that's between both of the women characters because what they're trying to avoid, basically.
It's the pain of women who had no rights before the revolution. Here again, Jennifer Baldwin-Peden as the Countess, Momoko Tano as Susanna singing Sularia from Theatre de la Juneland's production of Figaro in association with the Loeb Drama Center here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We spoke with company member Stephen Epp, Dominique Sorand, and Bradley Greenwald. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And I want to thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.